Welcome to the UAlbany News Podcast. I'm Sarah O'Carroll. I have with me Gabriel Hetland. His research focuses on urban and national politics, participatory democracy, and social movements. I have Hetland here to give insight on the political crisis in Bolivia following the resignation of former President Evo Morales and what to expect in the coming weeks.
As violent street protests over allegations of a stolen election in Bolivia forced President Evo Morales to resign and flee into exile.
Morales se encuentra este viernes en Argentina, donde va a permanecer en condición de refugiado.
Morales arrived in Buenos Aires, Argentina, with other former government officials as political asylees. Morales, who was in power for nearly 14 years in Bolivia, accepted an offer of political asylum from Mexico in November.
Gabriel, thank you for being here.
Yeah, pleasure to be with you, Sarah.
To understand what's happening in Bolivia, I think we need to take a step back and look at the weeks and even months leading up to the president's resignation. Can you help us make sense of why political unrest was growing and who the key players were that set this chain of events in motion?
Sure. To go back even further, very briefly, Evo Morales was elected in 2006. He was the first indigenous president in Bolivia's history. It's a majority indigenous country, so it was a very big deal when he got elected in 2005. He took office in 2006. And he'd been president since then. And so the current election, which happened on October 20th of this year, was controversial because in 2016, Morales attempted to change Bolivia's constitution, which allows only a single re-election, which he had already done. And he lost narrowly a referendum, and it was a little bit, you know, there's some dirty politics involved in his losing, but he clearly lost that referendum. About a year and a half later, the highest electoral court in Bolivia, the Supreme Constitutional Tribunal, declared that anyone could run for re-election and prohibiting them would be a violation of their human rights. And so that was a position that allowed Morales to run in this election in 2019, but it was widely rejected by some, not all, within Bolivia. So that sort of sets the context for the dispute, and there was increasing calls by mostly middle class and some more sort of right-wing conservative sectors calling Morales a dictator. I don't think that, you know, claim had a lot of analytical merit, but it was certainly made. So there was controversy even before the election. There was claims for months that the right wing within Bolivia, which is largely based in the eastern lowlands of the country, whereas Morales and the capital is in the highlands in the Andes, there was sort of calls that the election would not be free, that if Morales won, it would be a fraud, without any evidence, obviously. Mm-hmm. So this was even before. So there was a sort of narrative that was happening for a number of months before the election even happened. Then the election did happen on the 20th, and there's no dispute about the fact that Morales got the largest plurality. So the initial returns from a quick count showed that he had at least 45% of the vote, and the second place finisher had about 37 point something percent. So Morales was up by almost a little under 8% of the vote, but he would need to get 10% margin to avoid a second round runoff. And that was a big deal because if he had gone to a runoff, many people thought he might lose, including himself to some extent. And so as the full results came in, his margin increased from roughly 8% to over 10%, about 10.5%, 10.6%, which meant that he would have won the first round. But many people, in part for the narrative I already talked about, didn't believe that had happened. They thought that there had been fraud and there was no way Morales could have won the election in the first round. The OAS, the Organization of American States, played a very important and controversial role in all of this because on the morning of the 21st, so the day after the election, they came out with a statement saying that it was impossible for Morales to have gotten the change in his margin from 8% to 10.5%, that there's no way to explain that. That wasn't actually true. There was a good explanation. I'm not sure the explanation is true, but there was a good plausible explanation that the later returns coming in came from more pro-Morales areas. So rural areas and more peripheral areas in cities, which have lower income voters, more predominantly indigenous voters, who are overwhelmingly Morales supporters, at least in certain areas. So there was a lot of controversy about that. That a statement by the OAS and a widespread sense on the part of urban middle classes within Bolivia that fraud was the only way Morales could have won the election in the first round led to weeks of protests within Bolivia. So that's the sort of second thing to pay attention to, that there was popular protests going on, not working class, not lower class sectors. And it quickly became a right-wing phenomenon. So it didn't originate that way, but the right within Bolivia really took over the leadership of these protests and transformed it from something that was demanding a new election to demanding Evo Morales' resignation. And there were some leftist and popular movements, meaning trade unions and popular organizations that had traditionally and historically supported Morales, who also had historic grievances against him for complicated reasons that we may or may not have time to get into, who supported the protests. But by and large, they were urban middle classes, and they were led by a sort of right, which has a history of racism, a history of not really supporting democracy within Bolivia. The election itself, there's still a lot of questions about it. There's lots of claims of fraud. There's lots of claims of irregularities. I think it's not entirely clear what happened. There's just in the last day, the OAS has released its final report. I haven't had a chance to fully look at it, but it, you know, alleges a number of irregularities. It doesn't provide any smoking gun evidence of fraud. It more says that given the irregularities, we can't certify the result. But that's a little bit different than saying we have proof that there was fraud in the election. And even if one accepted, for the sake of argument, the idea that there was fraud, it's not clear how extensive it was or whether or not it even changed the margin. So there's a lot of unanswered questions about it, and there's a lot of sort of actions. But that led to a major conflict, which is sort of how we got to where we are now. On the weekend, 3 weeks after the election, so the weekend of the 9th and 10th of November, Bolivia had transitioned to a very chaotic situation. The day before, on the 8th of November, the police had mutinied against Morales. There's some evidence, which I think is compelling, suggesting this was preconceived, that there actually was indeed a coup plot, not by the military, but by elements of the police, by elements of the right wing within Bolivia. There's audio tapes which are sort of documenting this. I haven't looked at the authenticity of them, but people I trust say that they are authentic, so they are at least worth considering as an important source of information, documenting, you know, a plan to allege fraud, to get the OAS involved, to actually get a police mutiny, and then to have Morales resign, which is all happened. So the police mutiny happened on the 8th and 9th. There's a lot of complicated economic grievances that the police had. There was popular protests, which they weren't repressing, and so that's taxing, that's tiring, so there's various factors, but they having a state security force rebel against the president is a very serious thing. So that was probably the trigger that led to the end of Morales's regime, but the actual sort of final thing was on the morning of the 10th, two important things happened. First, the OAS released a preliminary report saying very clearly that they could not certify the results. So Evo Morales then said, okay, I accept that. I will call new elections, and I'll even bring a new electoral board in if people don't trust the old one. So that was a major concession compared to where he had been before, but it wasn't enough for protesters, and apparently it wasn't enough for the military, the head of which then called for Evo Morales to resign. So that's a significant factor, and there's been a lot of debate about the significance of that, but for many people, including myself, that's one important piece of why I think it makes sense to call this a coup. When the military gets involved and tells a democratically elected leader to leave office, even if they use the word like suggest, that's a very powerful thing. It's a very dangerous thing, and it has a really tragic history within Latin America. And the reason I called Evo Morales democratically elected is not because I necessarily accept one side or the other of the October 20th election, but because he was democratically elected without a doubt in 2014 with over 60% of the popular vote, and his term wouldn't have ended until January of 2020. So no matter what one thinks of the election, he was Bolivia's elected president. He was forced by the police mutiny, by some degree of popular protest, but then most of all at the end by the military to resign. It's very clear looking at the evidence that Morales and many leaders within his party, which is called the Movement to Socialism or MAS party, were afraid for their lives, or at least fearful for their physical safety. During the day that he resigned and during that entire weekend, there was physical attacks that happened on MAS members' houses. So MAS, again, is a political party. Morales' house after he resigned was ransacked. There's film showing it on television. Mm-hmm. The next day, he went into exile in Mexico, and there's compelling evidence showing that it was very difficult for Mexico to actually land a plane within Bolivia. Peru denied them airspace the next day. So even getting Morales out of the country was a challenge, and that lends substance to the idea that he had good reason to fear for his physical well-being. So his resignation led to a series of other resignations, again, in this climate of fear and violence, which was going on at the time. There was some violence from MAS supporters, but very quickly it became predominantly against indigenous people and against MAS supporters as well. So a series of people resigned, and that paved the way for a coup government to take hold, which happened on the day of November 12th, so 2 days after Morales resigned. And a far-right, little-known senator, Jeanine Añez, from the lowlands within Bolivia, she's from a department called Beni, and her party got 4% of the vote in this recent election, so she has no popular mandate whatsoever. She assumed the presidency, basically self-declared herself with an almost empty legislative chamber because the MAS senators were boycotting the session out of principle or out of fear. And there's some clear statements that some of them were really afraid. So that's sort of the background to the current regime. And then, I'm happy to talk about the really frightening and atrocious things that have happened now. But if there's any questions you want to clarify, we can do that too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And is meddling with elections part of Bolivia's political history as well, and that sort of informs why there was this anxiety towards the October 20th election with Morales?
Yeah, I think that there's not, in the last 13, 14 years since Morales has been in office, there has not been any widespread sense of a lack of electoral integrity. I think elections have been accepted as legitimate by all serious analysts. There has been no sort of history of widespread fraud. There's not a history of, significant documented fraud in recent times. Certainly in Bolivia's larger history, there are, reasons to suspect electoral fraud in the past. But in the last, decade plus, that has not been part of it. So I think the explanation for the initial impulse lies with the discontent about Evo Morales even running. So there was a widespread sense on, again, mostly middle class folks, that he just shouldn't have been running, that the Constitution prohibited it, and that the court decision allowing him to do it was illegitimate. And so a lot of people said the coup was him running, period, which is, it's an argument people are making, but from a legal point of view, he did have the right to run, however controversial that decision was. The election itself also, I will say that looking at the evidence, there are many questions that were raised. And so I think that the way the election was handled and questions about where the physical vote were placed at different points, the chain of custody, those are not entirely clear for some of the votes, not for all of the votes. And so those do raise some legitimate questions, which people have been asking. But I think that, the 2016-2017 sort of history largely explains it. And then there's another important factor, which is that Morales was never fully accepted as a legitimate president by the sort of white supremacists in the eastern lowlands. They made their peace with Morales for a number of years from, roughly 2010 to 2016. There was a sort of informal alliance between Morales and the agrarian elite, but they were never happy having a quote-unquote Indian as president. And there's a huge, very long and very horrible history of racism within Bolivia, which has resurfaced today as well under the current coup regime. So that resentment, that racism, fueled some of the backlash against Morales. And then the final sort of factor to keep in mind is the middle class has an ambiguous relationship with Morales, that he actually expanded the ranks of the middle class. There was very significant economic growth, averaging 5% during most of his period in office when a lot of Latin America was falling apart. So he was very successful. He expanded the ranks of the middle class, but he changed the relationship between the middle class and positions within the state because he opened those positions up to primarily indigenous social movement leaders, people from the working class, from the lower classes, or what in Latin America is often called the popular classes, meaning informal workers, rural small holding farmers, peasants, had access to positions within the state. And that lack of a monopoly by the more white middle class, urban middle class within Bolivia rankled. And I think that was one of the other factors. So there's a lot of complicated factors behind what's happening. But I think it's important to, you know, some of them we can pinpoint as the really strong ones, but the other ones we have to keep in mind also.
And why does it matter so much in the way that we talk about whether this was a coup or not? And what are the implications for how we're viewing this in terms of the state of democracy and the strength of democratic ideals in Bolivia?
Yeah, I think it matters in part just for the basic question of legitimacy of the new government. So if it's seen as a popular uprising that kicked Morales out, then it's seen as much more legitimate. If it's seen as a military coup or a civic coup or a right-wing coup, it's seen as much more illegitimate. And that has implications not only for, you know, how we characterize his departure from office, but also the current regime. And I think, frankly, the question of whether or not it's a coup, you know, regardless of one's stance on how Morales resigned, the character of the new regime, I think, has clarified that it is indeed a far-right coup government, because the new regime has governed in an incredibly repressive way. They have killed over 30 people, primarily, overwhelmingly, in fact, peaceful protesters who have rejected the very virulent racism of leaders of the new government, the interim president who is widely viewed as illegitimate by many people because of the manner in which she took office and the manner in which Morales left office. She has made statements which I think it's impossible to say are not racist in the past. Mm-hmm. She is very close to a far-right businessman, Luis Camacho, who is also, you know, clearly racist and has made very disturbing statements. Both of them are, I sort of would describe them as fervently Christian in the sense of wanting to impose Christianity on the state within Bolivia, which is supposed to be secular. Mm-hmm. When Morales left and in the days after, there was episodes of sort of violence against indigenous people throughout Bolivia. There was the Wipfala flag, which is an indigenous symbol of indigenous identity, which is held in honor by, you know, people throughout Bolivia, was burned publicly. There was police officers who ripped it off of their uniform in the eastern city of Santa Cruz. And so there was this sort of popular resentment against the government, and the government responded to that with brutal violence, with repression, killing protesters, injuring many hundreds, you know, close to 1,000 is the last report that I've heard. Hundreds were detained. There was an attack on freedom of the press. There were statements by the new government that if people were seditious or engaging in subversion, they would not be allowed to be journalists. There was statements against mosque leaders calling them animals, saying that they would be hunted down and that they would be stripped of their office, that they would be detained. Morales has been heard on a supposed audio tape, which may or may not be real, telling his supporters to engage in resistance, and that there would be conflict, which you can interpret in social terms, that there's a, you know, political and social conflict going on. But because of that, he's been labeled a terrorist. And there's a whole sort of discourse of demonization and criminalization of protest, criminalization of indigeneity within Bolivia right now. Mm. There was a decree that has since been rescinded, but it was around for several days, even a week, I think, exempting state security officers of any accountability for repression against forces within Bolivia. So regardless of how one characterizes the departure of Morales, regardless of whether or not you say it's a coup, the subsequent actions utterly lack legitimacy, they utterly lack accountability, and they've been really terrifying. So I think that justifies calling it a coup government right now.
Hmm. And it certainly looks like the conditions are very unstable at the moment and that a lot of different types of scenarios could play out. But based off what you've been seeing, can you speak to what some more likely scenarios, what they might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've left out that there was some somewhat more hopeful things, but they're ambiguous in the sense that there was an agreement after, you know, more than a week of violence and repression and several massacres after these, you know, truly horrifying decrees and statements against the media, against mosque leaders. There was an agreement that was brokered between the mosque-controlled legislature and the interim government of Áñez, which was calling for new elections. In which Morales and his vice president, Alvaro Garcia Linera, will not be participating. So there'll be new candidates. As far as I know, they haven't been named yet, but Morales has agreed to this. He wasn't a player to officially agree, but he supported it from Mexico, where he is in exile now. Social movements have ended their blockades by and large. So there's, you know, peasant movements, there's indigenous lowland movements, there's highland indigenous movements, there's street vendors, street federation, neighborhood associations in El Alto, a large primarily indigenous city near La Paz, the capital, which were engaged in very fierce and effective blockades for, you know, over a week. Those blockades were ended for the time being. There's been a sort of, largely at least, and there's been a, you know, some dialogue between the Áñez government and the MAS-controlled legislature calling for these new elections. So that's a hopeful development. There hasn't been nearly as much violence as there was in the past. I don't know of any recent episodes of killings, which is a good thing for sure. I think the repression has diminished significantly. But there hasn't been any accountability for the Áñez regime for the very brutal repression, which is, you know, some of the worst that Bolivia has seen in at least 15 years, you know, going back to 2003, and has echoes of the military dictatorships of the past, the level of repression we've seen over the last few weeks. So there does need to be accountability for that, and that hasn't happened. And it's not entirely clear if the new elections that are called will truly be free and fair. They can only be free and fair if MAS is guaranteed the right to participate, if there's a climate entirely free of violence, which would involve some accountability for people who've committed acts of violence in the past, and if there's, you know, freedom of the military, freedom of political organizing. So it's not clear if those freedoms will exist, and so there's real questions. But I think it's, you know, at least heartening to see that there's some progress. We're not at the low point we were at roughly a week ago.
Which seems to show just how quickly everything can, how fast this can go in different directions, but that's good to hear. You study social movements, and this must have been very interesting to be watching this play out. Have any social movements seemed remarkably strong in how they've been able to either grow in number and in their messaging? And if we look back on this in the future, how might we point out which ones were more successful, or is it too soon to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so Bolivia, you know, over the last 20 years, especially from 2000 to 2005, so the 5 years before Morales got elected, had probably the strongest social movements in the world. They toppled two presidents. They forced some major, you know, state reforms about gas nationalization, putting an idea about a constitutional assembly on the sort of national agenda. They were very significant in getting Evo Morales elected in 2005. But after he got elected, those movements inevitably demobilized to some extent. Some of them were absorbed within the Morales government. In the last, you know, 4 or 5 years of Morales's time, he did divide some of the popular movements. So there was questions about their ability to mobilize. I think those questions have been answered affirmatively, that Bolivia's social movements, movements of peasant farmers, movements of urban indigenous residents, movements of cocaleros, which is Evo Morales' base. So predominantly but not exclusively indigenous movements or people who identify as indigenous as an important part of who they are, have shown very strong ability to continue mobilizing. I think it's important to recognize that these are not blanket sort of MAS supporters. Some of them certainly are, some of them are not, but they're, you know, capable of mobilizing in defense of democracy, in defense of basic freedoms, in defense of legitimacy, and in defense of their dignity as indigenous people within Bolivia. So many of those things are, you know, we're moving in the direction before Morales, but there was a real strengthening of a sense of indigenous identity under Morales, and it's at least positive to see that that still exists today, despite the violence, despite the racism that we're seeing. So I think the lesson we've seen is that Bolivia's, you know, social movements remain fierce, they remain strong, they remain a force to be reckoned with. I think it's impossible to imagine that we would have had elections called as quickly as we have without the major mobilizations which happened. At one point, there was at least 70, at one, I think I might have heard over 100 blockades around the country. There was, you know, dozens or hundreds of marches that were happening. You know, some of them were fairly spontaneous things that people just came out and organized. A lot of them had, you know, local level leaders involved. And so I think that is something that's not going to go away. And that will be a very important factor in the future of Bolivia.
Well, I appreciate you helping us make sense of the situation. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the last thing, since we're in the United States, it's important to recognize that the U.S. government has had a bad role in all of this. The U.S. government very quickly recognized the Añez administration, the Añez regime. The Trump administration has made statements demonizing Mas, demonizing Morales, celebrating this new government.
And saying it's not a coup.
Saying it's not a coup, saying that it's a return of democracy. And I think just frankly, you know, the 30-some people who've died, the, you know, hundreds of people who've been injured, the incredible sort of racism that Bolivia's majority has faced suggests that this is not a return to democracy. This is not something that our government should be celebrating. There's political leaders on the opposite side, you know, typical people. Bernie Sanders stands out for very clearly calling it a coup. And so I think there's some leaders, but the stance of the, you know, the government here has not been positive, and I think that means that U.S. citizens have a role to speak out and really say, you know, this was not okay and our government shouldn't be supporting this.
Well, Gabriel, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for listening to the UAlbany News podcast. I'm your host, Sarah O'Carroll, and that was Gabriel Hetland. You can let me know what you thought of the episode by emailing us. We're at mediarelations@albany.edu, or you can find us on Twitter @UAlbanyNews.